This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a couple of issues from my comic book collection, which I grabbed out of the newly revived, resuscitated Quarter Bins at my local Half Price Books. Any books from my comic collection are eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for them. Were the issues worth 25 cents? Were they bargains at 25 cents? Or were they still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 197th episode of the Quarter Bin Podcast, we are looking at Mandrake the Magician 1 and 2 from Dynamite Comics / King Features from 2015. But first, a little feedback. Following up on feedback on the recent Superboy episode, Sir Martin of Grey had a comment or two. Unlike your good self and Sir Dr. Ange, I bought every issue of New Adventures of Superboy. I found it most refreshing in its nostalgic vibe, and prefer the superhero strip to the admittedly entertaining Dial H for Hero. Did I ever tell you that my pal Howard was credited with designing a sofa? No, Mort, I am pretty sure I would have remembered that. He adds, subplots such as Jonathan Kent running for the town council and Clark's classmate Lisa having a non-angsty crush on him felt new. And who doesn't like Yellow Perry? Well, you got me there, Mort. And then he dared me to risk the legendary wrath of Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, by saying his least favorite word four times. Actually, Professor, surely talking about a Rubik's Cube is okay? Well, Mart, I certainly hope so. Did you know that I used to know how to solve a Rubik's Cube? It has been a while meaning decades. And the last time I tried to solve one, the tricks and tips and patterns had fled my recollections. And then last time we covered an issue of Marvel Triple Action, and Bill from the Bat Pod called it another fun episode. Thank you, Bill. Billy D from Magazines and Monsters thanked me for helping him get partway through his morning commute. Fun episode as usual, Professor. Before the invention of the Epic Collections, I was on a mission to buy all of these reprint books simply because the originals are so pricey. Now, with those trades I mentioned, they've become slightly obsolete, especially considering the rising costs of back issues. Yes, unfortunately, even reprint books. I've definitely been heading into the trade market more recently. That's an excellent point, Billy. Yes, these days, there is not really any use for reprint books. Although, I have to expect that when back issue prices become less inflationary, when it all shakes out, those reprint titles may end up once again being the bargain back issues that really they ought to be. And Sir Martin reported in on this episode as well, saying that this, I think he meant the original Avengers issue, not this reprint, that this was the first color Avengers comic I ever saw in the UK. Most of all, he did agree with me on the title of that comic. Marvel Triple Action confused the heck out of me as a kid. They should have just changed the title to Mighty Creaky Avengers or something. This was a fun period for the characters, and that's even before we get to the art. Just look at the delightful characterizations from John Buscema. and inker George Bell. In the scene with Jan learning about her inheritance, I remember being knocked out by that splash page of Quicksilver flying. That was exciting. And Clint's white trench coat is beyond stylish. But boy, was the Red Guardian dull. Full marks for the pretendee Hydra, though. Professor, you mentioned that this was 1970s action. It was, of course, a reprint from the mid-60s. Until next time, Martin. And you see, friends, that is one of the benefits that accrue to members of the Relatively Geeky Roundtable. The right to correct me publicly, without fear of it subtly being edited out of the episode. But in my defense, Mart, 70s, 60s, all of that was so long ago, it just blurs together as far as I'm concerned. Okay? Social media support for that last episode came from Chris, from Professor Frenzy, which all these years later is still a show. Slang word, Scott. Al, from the Warlock Thanos podcast. Chris, the Charlton hero. The Stop, Let's Team Up podcast. The notorious JJG Jeremiah Jones Goldstein. Sir Dr. Ange, Chris Lydon 7. Karen, from Between the Pages. James, from Karen. Chris Willett, Shane Kelly, Sir Luke of the Upstate, Matt McKeegan, the Chief Fanhole in Charge, Derek William Crabb, Pat from the Long Box Crusade, Vic and Phoenix, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, the kind and generous Sutherlands, and our good friend Clinton from Coffee and Comics. Thank you all. Comments and support are appreciated. I'm actually going to start here with a bit of a history lesson, and then after the promo break, actually talk about our comics. I heard someone say that if comic book history starts with Action Comics number one, then comic book prehistory begins with the newspaper strips. And it's in that era where Mandrake comes into the picture. Of course, comic strips, newspaper strips, they were the holy grail, the primary goal of any cartoonist back in the early 1930s, including a couple of Cleveland boys named Siegel and Shuster. You've probably heard the stories of them heading from newspaper syndicate to newspaper syndicate trying to sell their comic strip about an alien Superman. Because that was the way to success. That was the way to riches, or what passed for riches in the day of the Great Depression. The way to stability, consistent paycheck, perhaps. And one of those role models, one of those early comic strip success stories, was Lee Falk. Before his most famous creation, The Phantom, appeared, his probably second most famous creation, Mandrake the Magician, debuted as a newspaper strip distributed by King Features on the 11th of June, 1934. Originally, it was written and drawn by Falk, although Phil Davis quickly took over on the art duties. Davis worked on the strip for 30 years until he passed away in 1964. Falk tapped Fred Fredericks to take over art, and they remained the team on the strip for the next 35 years. And yes, there is a history of ghosting in the comic strips, but there was no evidence that I could see that Davis and Fredericks were not the primary creators during this era. And the continuity of creators on these strips is simply amazing. When the vast majority of households had home subscriptions to their daily local newspaper, or maybe even two, daily local newspapers, because you need the morning and the afternoon ones. That really was where the money was in cartooning, even before Charles Schulz and Jim Davis became merchandising multimillionaires. So back to Mandrake, 1999, that was when creator, originator, Lee Falk passed away. Now, Fredericks remained the artist and also became the strip's writer at this point. Fredericks retired in 2013, which means he was on the strip for just under half a century. Unfortunately, that retirement left the current storyline unfinished, and a reprint from 1995 began the next day. That was the daily strip. The Sunday strip ended earlier in 2002. So if you weren't following the dates, let me reiterate, the strip began in 1934 and ended in 2013, which is 79 years of daily newspaper strips and a pretty paltry, if you think about it, 68 years of Sundays. Of course, compared to the 109 years that the Katzenjammer kids ran, or the 86 years of Little Orphan Annie, it doesn't sound all that impressive, maybe. And actually, from what I could tell, there are a handful of strips that began before Mandrake that are still going on, meaning that the Katzenjammer kids may be dethroned in a decade or two. These include Blondie, Dick Tracy, and Gasoline Alley. By the way, the website phantomtrail.com provides everyday Mandrake and Phantom strips from the past. And I didn't poke around too far, but it is possible to unlock older ones as well. So if you're interested in the Lee Falk comic strip legacies, that is a place to start. So back to the origin of Mandrake comics. Historian Don Markstein is quoted as saying, "Some people say Mandrake the Magician, who started in 1934, was comics' first superhero." Actually, sometimes he is joined by the Phantom Magician from Mel Graff's strip, The Adventures of Patsy, as the first two superheroes in comics history. And this, of course, meant he was destined to appear in other media. And in 1939, Columbia produced a 12-part Mandrake the Magician serial based on the King Features strip, starring Warren Hull as Mandrake and Al Kakumi as his faithful Lothar. That serial is available on DVD. Mandrake the Magician was also a 15-minute radio serial, which aired on the Mutual Broadcasting System for a little under a year and a half, November 1940 until February 1942. And as comic books became popular, Mandrake certainly had opportunities to move into that format, although to be fair, to be honest, he was never really that successful in floppies. He was prominent in Magic Comics, a compilation of newspaper comic strip reprints published between 1939 and 1949. Mandrake was the cover star for issues 8 through 24. And beginning with issue 25, an illustration of the character became part of the magazine's logo. Again, these were not new stories in comic books, but newspaper reprints. Dell Comics published a single Mandrake the Magician issue in its four-color comic book series that featured various main characters going in and out of the title. It's issue 752, that's the Mandrake issue. And this one did contain original stories by Stan Campbell and Paul Newman. No, not that Paul Newman. In 1966-67, King Comics published 10 issues of Mandrake the Magician. Most of the stories, again, were remakes of past newspaper strips, and Mandrake also ran as a backup in other King titles, King Comics. This was the comic book arm of King Features, which was the syndicate that distributed the newspaper strips. Marvel got the license briefly, I guess, because they released a Mandrake miniseries in 1995, written by Mike W. Barr, with painted art by Rob Ortaleza. However, only two of the three-issue miniseries ever saw the light of day. I did not dig into this next part, but given the lack of a canceled comics cavalcade at Marvel or its equivalent, I don't know if anything from that missing third issue has ever surfaced. And just between us, I don't think I've ever seen either of the existing two issues of that title either. Despite this lack of comic book success in the US, Mandrake has enjoyed success in comic books in Australia, Brazil, and all across continental Europe. In the Nordic countries, he tends to be a backup in Phantom comic books. Mandrake is also popular in India, published through Indrajal Comics. In some of those countries, he has such a presence in pop culture that he is entered into common sayings. In Italy, there's a popular saying that translates into, "I'm no Mandrake," meaning, "I can't do what's impossible." And in Colombia, there's a popular saying that translates to, "Only Mandrake would know," meaning, you know, only someone who was all-knowing or had, you know, mental powers could ever know that. Okay, that is enough comic book history and enough Mandrake history, although I don't think we're totally done with that, to be perfectly honest. All that being said, it's time to take a break here, and after this promo, we'll actually get to Mandrake the Magician issues 1 and 2.
Hi, everyone. This is Corinne Norton, host and sometimes narrator of this brand new podcast, Finding Fantasy Reads, where I find amazing fantasy short stories to share with you so you can then find your next favorite author. I wanted to start this podcast because I wanted someone to weed through the hundreds of fantasy authors and handpick the good ones for me. And then because I'm super lazy, I also wanted someone to spoon feed me short stories so I could sample the author's style for myself before reading their full-length novels. When I realized no one was going to do that for me, I decided to turn around and do that for everyone else. Every week, you'll get to hear a new fantasy short story. At the end, I'll be sure to share how you can find more of their stories if you like what you heard. I hope to keep the episodes between 30 and 60 minutes, but fantasy authors can be long-winded, so don't hold me to that. In fact, the very first episode will go a little over an hour, but I promise it will be worth it. And speaking of the first episode, keep an eye out for it on June 6th, which is when the podcast will officially launch. I will be limiting the stories to clean fantasy because I want to keep the non-explicit rating for the podcast and because I have 4 kids, and at least 2 of them are going to want to listen to this. Because clean can be defined a number of ways, I'll try to give you a simple comparison for how I'm defining it for the podcast. Language will stay in the G range. Romance or spice might creep up to the PG range. And violence might get up to PG-13. My goal is to explore all sorts of subgenres within the larger fantasy genre so we can all experiment together. As I said before, I'm Corinne Norton. I'm a reader like you, but I'm also an author of epic fantasy. My first book won't be released until later this year, but I promise at some point I'll be sharing one of my own short stories on the podcast. If you have any questions, they're probably answered on findingfantasyreads.com. You'll also find information there about our monthly giveaways, which is something I'm super excited about. Thanks so much for checking out Finding Fantasy Reads. I expect that we're both about to discover a ton of amazing new stories and authors.
And we're back. King, Mandrake the Magician, numbers 1 and 2, and that is the official name of the book if you're looking it up. Dynamite included the name King in the title as part of the license with the King Features characters, a way of celebrating King's 100th anniversary. At this same time, Dynamite used their licensing deal to put out four other miniseries with classic King Features Syndicate characters, comics you may have seen. So in addition to Mandrake, they did Flash Gordon, Prince Valiant, The Phantom, and Jungle Jim. So, King, Mandrake the Magician 1 and 2, had cover prices of $3.99 each, meaning that I got each one from Half Price Books recently at a more than 93% discount. Yes! I mentioned a few episodes back where I confessed that I almost stopped the podcast with 193. I mentioned that one of the things that inspired me, motivated me, energized me, was the fact that a couple of locations of Half-Price Books had reintroduced some 25-cent bargain clearance boxes. And it was from those earlier here in 2023 that I found these two issues. Now, these had cover dates of, well, I can't find months anywhere in the cover or in that indicia. The closest I can get is that the Dynamite in the News column for issue one, that's dated February 2015. And for number two, it's dated June 2015. But that seems like an awful lot of time between issues. So let's just go with early to mid-2015. The cover of issue one, at least the one that I have, there were a number of variants. The one that I have is by Darwin Cook, whose old-timey style works so well presenting a character from the Golden Age, or even, as we said earlier, before the Golden Age. Mandrake is levitating cross-legged with doves flying out in every direction. A swirly circle behind him, his black and white and red color scheme looking great. It's a very solid poster image. And on the inside of that front cover, we get Previously, which caused me to flip back to the front of the cover and make sure I didn't pick up issue two by accident. But no, this is issue one, and yes, there is a Previously. It turns out that a few years before this, in 2013, Dynamite launched a miniseries called King's Watch, which I have a vague recollection of. And in that, similar to Defenders of the Earth, Mandrake and Lothar teamed up with the Phantom, Flash Gordon, Dale Arden, and Hans Zarkov. The series pitted those six characters against Cobra and Ming the Merciless. So this miniseries is a follow-up to that miniseries. Okay, got that. So for table setting purposes, let's see what we can glean from this Previously paragraph. A merciless conqueror attacked Earth, knocking our technology back 100 years. But Earth's defenders rebelled and prevailed. Yet while unconquered, Earth feels the aftershocks of war's terrible toll. So it seems like we're looking at some type of alternate Earth back to the pre-industrial state, something like that. So, okay, let's go. The stories in both issue one and two are untitled, written by Roger Langridge, with art by Jeremy Treese. And issue one starts 5 years ago. Mandrake, identifiable by his tuxedo jacket and bow tie, though lacking his top hat, finds himself in a wintry landscape. And in there, Mandrake's main squeeze, Narda, leaves the magician's side to take up with Cobra, Mandrake's arch nemesis. We see that this scene is happening in Mandrake's imagination. He's daydreaming as he's holding a snow globe in his hand, and he's muttering the word Narda softly. Okay, a couple more points to clarify here. This is not Cobra with a K, like the DC villain. It's Cobra with a C, but it's not Cobra Command, the terrorist nemesis of G.I. Joe. This Cobra was Mandrake's most persistent foe, despite appearing to have died back in 1937. But good on the creators, because it wasn't until 1965 that he came back. Cobra's primary priority is often attempting to acquire one of the two crystal cubes, items of untold power. Now, at this point in the issue, two pages in, it's unclear what version of the old school characters are being used, what continuity, if any, is occurring. But it should be noted that at some point in the comic strip publication history, Mandrake learned that Cobra was his very own half-brother. But that might not be the case here. This daydream is also a reference to where we are in this Dynamite King Features continuity. At some point, probably in that King's Watch miniseries, Narda was distressed that her husband was aging at a different rate than she was because of his magic. So she looked for magical means to make herself young again, and in her desperation, she performed a ritual that summoned the demon Acheron. After a long and hard battle, Mandrake contained Acheron in an urn, or in a vase, but he paid the price, and Narda left Mandrake to join forces with the Cobra. So that's what this daydream, this scene with the snow globe is representing. So that is where this story starts in terms of continuity and context. By the way, Acheron begins with the letters A-C-H, so I may well pronounce it Acheron at some point if I don't catch myself. But for future reference in the next 15 or 20 minutes, Acheron or Acheron, if you hear me say either of those names, know that they are the same demonic being. So finally, back to the comic, and I think that might be our last digression from the comic. We have Mandrake speaking to the disembodied voice of Acheron, and the demon calls Mandrake a fool. "I could get her back if you would set me free," he offers. "My magic, real magic, could restore." But Mandrake cuts off the demon, placing a glass dome over the urn, the artifact that contains Acheron. Mandrake tells the demon that his foul magic is not the only kind that can change the world, and he heads off to put on a show. Actually, he's putting on a press conference to announce that he's going to be putting on a show. This will be his return to stage magic. And we get a page representing the front page of a newspaper announcing the return. Legendary magician announces charity gala for emergency relief fund. On that page, we also have a story that begins occasional sightings of homeless men who resemble warriors from the planet Mongo continue to be reported to the authorities. Which could just be world building, could be referencing what is happening in those other King miniseries, or that could be foreshadowing to this series. At his high-tech mansion, Xanadu, Mandrake performs for the upscale crowd, demonstrating his super-hypnotism power. Remember, he's older than Superman, and Mandrake used super-hypnotism before and after Superman ever did. He had it first, and it is the nature of his illusion power between his voice and certain movements of his hands and his fingers. He can hypnotize individuals and crowds. Now, during the stage show, he introduces a fellow magician, actually a lady magician, Karma. They continue the show, trading spells back and forth. At that moment, around the world, we see a series of break-ins. Magical items are being stolen. In New Zealand, Taipei, and two locations that are important to Mandrake. One, the Royal Palace of Cockayne in Europe, the home of Mandrake's lost love, Narda, and also right there at Xanadu. There, a man and woman are examining various magical items, and the demon Acheron begins to speak to the lady. "Get me out of here," he promises. "In the sky's the limit." Despite the standing ovation which follows the performance, Mandrake tells Karma that there will be no encore. He tells her that the reason he so rarely performs magic, uses real magic, that is not his lack of ability. "It is the cost," he says, showing her his ugly, damaged hands. They discuss the differences between being a wizard, which he is, and the less damaging witch magic, which she uses. She does question why he is not out there fixing the world, and instead putting on entertainments for the idle rich. "Thank you, Karma. I had the exact same question, and I wonder if that conversation was put in there to answer that potential reader question." But they are interrupted by a bong, bong, bong. The alarm. "My occult chamber has been compromised." Karma says that she thought that Ming fried all the electronics, but Mandrake says that this is a magical alarm. "It only goes off when someone tampers with the most powerful, the most dangerous items in my collection." Karma gets the door to the room open, and on the last page, we see a red-headed lady in there holding the vase, the urn, that holds the demon. "Surprised, false wizard? Come on, you knew I'd get out eventually. Acheron!" To be continued. In Mandrake the Magician number 2, the cover of which is by Chip Zdarsky. This is the main cover, and there was one variant. We start elsewhere. Actually, the Royal Palace of Cockayne, which, there is no way to say this word, Cockayne, without sounding inappropriate in any potential number of ways. But here, we see a woman instructing a couple of dudes carrying a magical mirror to place it gently, gently, with the rest of the magical hoard. She turns, and we see it is Narda. "While I find out what's been happening to my ridiculous husband and his witch friend." And then we go back to her ridiculous husband and his witch friend, who are being mystically battled by the demon Acheron, who is in the body of the female thief named Cleopatra. Mandrake knows that Acheron's escaping simply isn't possible. He sees a glowing amulet around Cleopatra's neck and hypothesizes that this is all happening in our minds. It turns out that he's right. The demon is still in the urn, casting an illusion that he is free. The thieves try to escape through a portal, and Mandrake and Karma jump through, following. They all end up at Narda's feet. Mandrake is shocked at the pile of artifacts that she has accumulated. He calls the hoard dangerous, which she replies with, "I think the word you're looking for is powerful." It turns out that Narda has turned the acolytes that Ming left behind to follow her. Only faith in the Cobra God has given them a purpose. She leaves the room, ordering the acolytes to not kill them. For all our differences, Mandrake is still the only man I've ever truly loved. In her own chambers, she disrobes like a good magical person. All she was wearing was a robe. And then she mystically appears in flame before leaders around the world. Clearly, President Obama, probably German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and a number of others, pointing out that her nation of Kakane has one resource that no one else has. Magic. I'm casting a spell which will age you all 10 years. If after 24 hours all executive powers have not been handed over to Kakane, I will age you 100 years. Those of you who survive that will find the next spell will age you 1,000 years. I am quite sure such a display will not be necessary. Which I have to say, as a fan of the hardball realpolitik often exercised by a certain Latverian leader, all I have to say is that this is an impressive power play. Back where Mandrake and Karma are being held, many green snake-like aliens are surrounding them holding weapons. But a little hand-waving magic and a little super-hypnotism, and they have almost convinced the acolytes that the Cobra God only speaks through Mandrake. He almost gets them to overthrow the great Cobra, aka his ex-wife Narda, but she prevails. She takes no pleasure in grinding him under her heel like a bug, like I said, ex-wife. But you insist on getting in my way. Again, he asks her to disperse the magical artifacts, and she responds by slapping him across the face. Like I said, ex-wife. And then, on the last page, Mandrake and Karma are marched down and down and down. Mandrake's hands are contained, so his hypnotic gestures no longer work. So it's the dungeons, I'm afraid. Narda gives Mandrake a day or two to think it over. For old time's sake, she says. Either you can join me as the consort of the new Empress of Earth, or you can rot. To be continued. Boy, that was quite a ride. I have found that in my reading of fantasy, and I've read a lot of fantasy, novels, short stories, comic books, that there are a lot of different stories in that genre. But two themes come up again and again and again. And this story contains one of those two common themes, common tropes almost. It's not the most common, or at least the most overdone to my taste. That is the death of magic. You know, magic is dying and the magic persons have to fix it. I have read that a ton of different times, and there's a good chance that you have as well. The second one, common, although much less common than magic is dying, is this one, the accumulation of artifacts. And in fantasy stories, that accumulator of a hoard is often a dragon, especially if the hoard is gold and jewels and pretty baubles. The dragon may also be a hoarder of mystical artifacts, but that is more often than not the province of a wizard, sometimes a good wizard, who fears the power falling into the wrong hands. but more often like this, like Narda's motivation. It is to accumulate the power to oneself and do something like, you know, take over the planet. What does Narda envision herself becoming as I scroll up? That's right. The new Empress of Earth. So, not a totally new story. That doesn't mean it can't work, but I thought it worth a mention. Also wanted to talk about an area that I don't talk enough about on these episodes, and that's the art. And in this case, what I have to say is that I don't love it. My first choice is usually a closer hewing to reality, but I certainly see the role of exaggeration in comic book art, of stylized figures, and some of that I like, some of those artists I like. But these characters here just seem too angular for my taste, mostly in the faces. There's a hint of going into the manga direction. It doesn't look like manga, but it's taking that concept of exaggeration in expression and then, you know, running with it in a different direction. Maybe I was expecting a bit of simplicity in the drawing style because of the comic strip pedigree of the character, but I suppose they wanted to go a different direction. This extra style of the art works when Mandrake or the demon Acheron are doing illusions, or magic is being performed, but using it throughout the entirety of these issues, I'm more meh on that. Again, it has a look. It has a consistent look that is in the book's favor, I suppose, but it's not my favorite look. There are some things in the story, in the comics, that I do like. Oh, one thing I should have mentioned during the synopsis was that at the press conference in issue one, the magician calls on three reporters by name, Lee, Phil, and Fred. This is a tribute to those comic strip creators of Mandrake that we mentioned in the first segment. And in case that's not obvious, the quote-unquote photo credit on the fake newspaper page is credited to L. Falk. I like the character of Karma, the fact that she practiced her magic in a way distinct from Mandrake. That's one nice bit of world-building in a couple of issues that didn't do so great on the world-building. And Narda is certainly a pistol. She may be one of those people who is energetic and magnetic, the kind of person who can make a positive first impression just by their overwhelming nature. Maybe the kind of person that could cause Mandrake to fall in love at first sight, but with whom a long-term relationship would be a struggle. A challenging person to live with, I would guess. I called her his ex-wife, although technically, I'm not sure of their current relationship status, other than it's complicated. She left him to join the Cobra, so she certainly switched sides, but I don't know what legal processes the relationship has been subject to. She does offer Mandrake the position of consort, which leads me to believe they aren't currently married, but hard to say. And actually, as you may have noticed by how long it took me to actually get to the meat of these issues, to get through all of the backstory, all of the previously material, a lot of these issues was hard to say. My first pass at reading this, I was left quite confused. All of that context and back matter that I added during the synopsis, that was, like, not in the story. It was doing some research on the history of Mandrake, the details of this miniseries. the process of putting this episode together that I learned most of that stuff, the stuff that added enough context so that this story started to make a bit more sense to me. And once I knew what the plot was, what the context was, I kind of dug it. But I really had to dig into this in order to figure out how much I dig reading this. So the relationships, I think, were the strength of the issues. But there were some problems that I had in addition to the art. As I read the first issues without research or without context, I had no idea whatsoever that this was in the aftermath of a cataclysm, that technology had been moved 100 years into the past. It just didn't seem to be the case. There appear to be very little changes in the world from what our world is. Which, given what I was told about the world after the fact, about this cataclysm, this reversion of technology, I have trouble buying it. All the nations have their leaders. There appears to have been no wars that changed boundaries. There seemed to be no degradation in the technology. And that's part of what I mean by the poor world building. So it were just elements of this that I didn't get. I like the fact of all of the leaders being present. That was fine. It gave it some grounding, which can be good in a fantastical story. But then the stylized art, that to me conflicted with the grounding of having real characters in the story. So that to my taste was a bit of a clash. But then again, there's way too much of this taking place in a world just like ours, bearing no visible or obvious, clear effects of this supposed lack of technology. Karma mentions it when the alarm goes off, and Mandrake tells her it works because it's a magical alarm, not electrical. But everywhere else in the issue, I think I see lights. There's no evidence of gaslight or torches. Yes, there are torches in the dungeon, but of course there are. And this is, in essence, a fantasy work, and I expect better world building. Yes, this is 45 pages or so of illustrated storytelling and not the 510 dense pages you'd expect from a fantasy novel or the thousands of pages you'd get in an epic fantasy series. But here, I really do think that the show conflicts with the tell. But all that being said, I like the overall plot, the overall story, more than some of the details. At this point, Narda looks poised to take control of the world. I talked about it in the synopsis, but the nature of her threat, her ability to age the world leaders at a distance, there is something to be said about wielding power like that. An impressive display, a memorable display. That scene is probably the highlight of the two issues. And it does want me to keep reading to find out what happens next, despite some of the drawbacks that I saw. So how will all these mixed feelings, this balancing of the positives and negatives, how will all that work out in forming my final verdict? The verdict on King, Mandrake the Magician 1 and 2. These are okay. They're not great. And it took me a lot of effort to get into them to figure out the structure, who was who, and what was happening. But on the other hand, there was some good, solid stuff in here. And it is cool to read a story about a character with this much of a history. The scales tip, not overwhelmingly, but decidedly in the direction of the good outweighing the bad. These are not great. But I'd like to know what happens in issues 3 and 4. By definition, that makes these two issues, quarter bin deals. And that wraps up our coverage of King, Mandrake the Magician 1 and 2, bringing episode 197 of the Quarter Bin Podcast to a close. Next time, we're heading not to the basement where the Quarter Bin collection resides, but we're heading to the bookshelf to look at a fancy prestige format offering. It's Black Hawk Kid, number one. If you know, you know. If you have any questions or comments about these issues, the episode, old-time newspaper comic strip characters, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin.
Quarter Bin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.